Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Now on ABC Radio National Summer, it's time for Hindsight. The European relationship to the land that we've settled on is a theme which occurs and reoccurs in Australian history. Today's Hindsight explores it in a very particular way, through the flowers and plants that grow here. Flowers have many meanings for us, and for Georgiana Molloy, who landed in Western Australia in 1830, they became her passion. She has a powerful presence in the history of Australian botany, but increasingly she's also captured the hearts and minds of contemporary artists and writers. Producer Jennifer Bowen went to the southwest of Western Australia to discover the story of Georgiana Molloy.
Okay, let me show you our collection room where we keep our specimens. Here's Boronia molloyae. It's a particularly beautiful plant. It was very tall. I think Georgiana Molloy mentioned that this was as high as a man on a horse.
You know, your body gets to learn the feel of the air, the smells. The smell of eucalyptus after rain in summer is just so evocative.
Oh, yes, Georgiana Molloy. Let's see, where did I first hear of her?
Because I'm writing a play, I'm looking for the drama of it. She was a kind of alpha person. She's a perfectionist.
I read a book, a great big fat book biography of her that came out a few years ago. And also, I'm very interested in flowers myself, so she really caught my attention.
Georgiana Molloy, yeah, the seeds and pods of trees and flowers of New Holland, presses leaves and flowers.
When she comes here, the circumstances she finds herself in are so extreme that she has to change.
There was something going on with the way that she wrote about botanizing and being outside. It was very poetic and very passionate, and I thought this needs to be explored. This lovely woman
of botany. I beheld a tree of great beauty. It is dark green and prickly. The flowers are of the purest white and fall in long tresses from the stem. On nearer view, I found the buds much more beautiful than the full-blown flower. The natives call it danja. I rather think it will turn out to be a hakia.
After my first book, I was looking around for somebody who'd come to Australia in the early years of British settlement and who wasn't consumed with transforming the land, with making it into something that it wasn't, with changing things, with becoming rich. Somebody who actually came to appreciate it for what it was, on its own terms, and came to terms with those terms. And I think I found that in Georgiana Molloy.
There's a stone which marks the first landing along the coast here, halfway to Flinders Bay. It's along the coast a bit. They had a small boat and they brought it in through the surf to the coast.
I met Jessie Allen Williams at her home in Augusta.
And we used to go to the Historical Society meetings. We were missing history, I think, having come from England in 58. This was about 1960. That was when we fell in love with the story of Georgiana.
We talked about Georgiana Molloy, the admiration many people have for her, and the difficulties of her early life. How she'd arrived in the southwest with a party of settlers clutching Bibles and charts, waiting for maps to show where they were, and waiting for names to know where they were. Georgiana Molloy had a part to play in the naming process that followed, not with expeditions seeking out rivers and pastures, but closer to home, discovering the features of the country almost underfoot. She also discovered the power of writing, finding it as much for herself, perhaps, as those she captivated later. The interest in Georgiana Molloy has been fuelled by two books about her. One first published in 1955 by the late Alexandra Haslack, now reprinted twice, and the second, more recent, by William Lyons. He's looked into the early life of Georgiana Molloy for clues to her later passion.
Georgiana Molloy's family came from Carlisle in northern England, quite close to the border with Scotland. She came from quite a well-off family. Her father had been and was mayor of Carlisle. But she became very religious in her teens. This is the 1820s. She was getting on in those days, about 24 or something, before she met somebody who asked her to marry him. That was Captain John Molloy. He had been an army veteran, had fought with Wellington, a little bit older than her. He was about 40, I think. But it was a love match, and John Molloy promptly proposed that they go to Western Australia, and she said, yes, let's go.
And on Sunday, we went to hear the Reverend Mr. Irving. He asked the congregation to pray for the new settlement and for those two lately joined in wedlock.
That they may be like Abraham and Sarah in the land to which God has allotted them.
In the late 1820s, there was what's called Swan River fever. It was mainly created by Captain Stirling and a few henchmen of his to create an extraordinary speculative interest in Western Australia and settling Western Australia. And he managed to convince the government of the day that he could be in charge of basically a private settlement. Now, there were a lot of people, particularly second sons, who didn't inherit anything in Britain, but who saw this as a chance to become landowners. And landowning, of course, was everybody's ambition in those days.
She arrived in 1830. There'd been quite a lot of activity on the eastern coast, and that was happening in a particular way. But it was almost like, coming that little bit later.
Angela Campbell works in theatre. Originally from Melbourne, she currently lives in Fremantle.
The mythology around emigration was quite developed. So she came with this package of expectation and landed somewhere which was incredibly foreign and incredibly undeveloped, so there was a big mythology hitting a big reality.
Everybody who came out from England was struck and frequently noted in their correspondence that the land was grey and dull.
That's a botanist speaking. Kevin Teely is the curator of the WA Herbarium.
Most of our native plants have a less green foliage than European and English plants. The reason for that, very simply, is that there's no lack of sunlight here, and so, capturing sunlight isn't very difficult. Plants in Europe have to have vivid green leaves in order to capture as much sunlight as they can. And the second reason is that in Australia, because the soils are so poor, once a plant creates a leaf, it has to invest a lot of energy into making a leaf, and it has to hold onto that leaf for as long as it can to get every, drop of goodness from that leaf. Australian leaves will live for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, whereas in European plants, a leaf lasts for a season.
Captain John Molloy, Mrs. Georgiana Molloy, property imported by applicant in the Warrior, arrived Fremantle March 11, 1830. Two ploughs, two harrows.
Swan River.
One car.
4th of April, 1830.
One truck.
My dearest Mama, we arrived here on Sunday the 11th of March after a boisterous voyage from the Cape. As we approach the mainland, the scene is very striking. The trees are full growth, with branches untroubled by the storm and unpruned by man.
700 weight flour, 400 weight split peas, 300 weight rice.
By the time they got to Swan River, which was the site of the main settlement, they'd found that all the land for miles around the settlement had already been taken up. Now, the Stirlings told them, or Captain Stirling told them, don't worry, there's great land to be had in the southwest of Western Australia. They had to repack all their gear in another ship and sail down to the south coast to the mouth of the Blackwood River, where they founded the settlement of Augusta, just a handful of settlers.
They do enact the first landing occasionally on notable anniversaries, but I'm sure it's not the same.
The beauty of the place was very significant in wanting to portray, cinematically at least, the scene.
Janet West has written a play, and now a screenplay, about Georgiana Molloy.
I was quite carried away by that great junction of Indian Ocean and Great Southern Ocean with the dangerous reef of Cape Leeuwin jutting out into the middle, and that reef is important in the film.
Augusta's right on the point where the west coast becomes the south coast. That's the Indian Ocean confronting the west coast, and it's the Southern Ocean confronting the south coast, and the Southern Ocean continues with Antarctica, and they meet right at that cape. I mean, the waters join, and you can see it in the turbulence of the waters.
Monday, 24th of May, 1830. Elizabeth Mary, the only child of John and Georgiana Molloy, was born.
And within a few days of arriving, Georgiana Molloy, who had been pregnant for the whole trip out, gave birth to a daughter. Of course, the daughter wasn't well, given the condition of the mother after a long, long sea voyage.
Wednesday, 26th of May. I gave her a little magnesium, but her feet and legs were icy cold. About six, she seemed to twist her features as she shrieked. When she cried and refused any food, I began to fear the worst.
The girl, the baby, died within a few days.
My dearest Helen, language refuses to utter what I experienced when mine died in my arms in this dreary land, with no one but Molloy near me. Its grave, though sodded with British clover, looks so singular and solitary in this wilderness, of which I can scarcely give you an idea.
You got the carry trees down here. They shed their bark, and depending on how much rainfall there is in the year, you get different shades of orange underneath with the new skin when the old bark falls away. And it's just so beautiful, and they're so very, very tall. When my mother came to visit, I took her into Baranup Forest to go birdwatching. And she just got laughing because the trees were just so tall. You know, you couldn't really see the birds. They were too far up in the sky.
And in those days, the Carrie Forest grew right down into Augusta. Those are tremendously large trees, bigger than anything she would have seen in Britain. So there would have been a lot of sights and sounds that would have been very, very new.
My dearest Eliza, we have now been living on salt pork and beef ever since we left England. For variety, I have the meat stewed with turnips, carrots, parsnips and onions, but we have not even a sufficiency of potatoes yet. We keep them for seed.
The sandiness of the earth, I think that's the thing that really got me. You dig a little way and it's just sand. It's all sand. And you think, how can you grow anything in the sand? And in order to grow a cultivated, you know, culture, you have to put lots of compost in and lots of this and lots of that. But only the things that want to grow will grow.
The native flowers are all exceedingly small but beautiful in colour. I only know three kinds, and those are two white and one blue. You could not send old Georgie a greater treat than some seeds, both floral and culinary. In return, I will send you some Australian seeds.
Georgiana's first child was born very soon after they arrived at the Blackwood River settlement, under a tent in the driving rain with just an umbrella held above her to stop the rain coming in. That little baby died after just a week. And she talks about the joy she received from opening a box of seeds that she'd brought with her and planting that box of seed on the baby's grave. And very quickly she turned to creating a garden around that house that they were building, looking over the Blackwood River.
August 4th. Sowed many garden seeds. Rain and wind in the evening. September 4th. Sowed all the hardy annuals.
She planted a lot of what would have been standards at the time, wallflowers and nasturtiums and a lot of pinks by the sound of it, dianthus, anemones, peonies. She writes to her sister, I think, with disappointment at one stage because the thistle seeds didn't germinate and she wants some more and she wants some fresh ones this time. Some kind of remembrances of home, I think, in there that we wouldn't necessarily appreciate.
Garden historians Holly Kerr Forsyth and Sue Martin of La Trobe University. Of particular interest to them is the significance of gardens in early settlement for women. Holly Kerr Forsyth.
Creating a garden for these women was significant in many ways. It was an attempt to domesticate and familiarise the wilderness that they found, but I also think that it was a way of them re-empowering themselves. These women had suffered loss on so many different levels. They'd come to a new colony, often not out of their own choice, and creating a garden, setting those boundaries, creating beauty within those boundaries, I think for them was a way of taking back power and controlling their environment to a certain extent, where the seasons would go full circle, where rebirth would happen after winter. I certainly think they pine for that.
I am overpowered with work and expect an addition to my family in the spring and have not a cap to put on the child's head. God bless and protect you. Your devotedly attached sister, Georgiana Molloy.
Georgiana Molloy's second child was a healthy daughter called Sabina, and she became the eldest of a large family. We have an idea of Georgiana's inner life throughout the time her family grew because of her correspondence, much of which is in the State Library of WA. Driving there, I was reminded of a conversation I'd had with Patricia Clark earlier in Canberra. Some years ago, she worked on a collection of letters by early women settlers to Australia.
It was enormously important to them, particularly to those ones who came so early. Many of them came with any expectation that they would ever return home again, so that letters were their link, their lifeline to the family and friends that they'd left behind. And of course, the women who came here had a great deal of news to tell. They faced a very different life. They had a lot more physical work, a lot more responsibility often than they would have ever have had in England in a more stratified society.
November 7, 1832. My dearest Eliza, today is my darling baby's first birthday. I am obliged to scribble, work and nurse, besides tidying the rooms whenever I can. This is certainly a very beautiful place. But were it not for domestic charms, the eye of the emigrant would soon weary of the unbounded limits of thickly clothed, dark green forests.
Letter writing was a sort of woman's art. It gave them a private world, really, where they could express themselves.
What were the practicalities of letter writing in those days?
Very, very difficult. Paper was scarce, postage was very dear, so that it was important to keep them small. This led to that practice which a lot of people have come across in old letters of cross-writing. They'd write a page of a letter in the usual way, then turn it sideways and write across. And this made them quite difficult to read, but it, of course, increased the amount of news you could, or the amount of views you could convey.
My dear and much beloved Helen, on the 16th of June this year, my third daughter was born. During the day while baby sleeps, which is very little, I mend what I can, wash her caps, make the puddings, weigh the rations and write, if not pressed by some.
These are the letters of Georgiana Molloy, one of our very significant early Western Australian settlers.
David Whiteford, archivist at the State Library of WA.
It's a collection of letters to various friends and relations from Georgiana. Some of them have the cross-writing, which makes them extremely difficult to decipher. Her writing was actually fairly neat.
My dearest Mama, I do not hesitate to say that I am overwhelmed with too much labour.
So this one starts off. November the 9th, 1832. I fear we are thought inattentive to our friends, but we have never yet omitted writing whenever there was an opportunity.
The fourth attempt, dearest Mama, to write, and I had scarcely written the date when baby began to cry from her cot. She has not been so well lately.
That one I can't pick, as our lives afford no other subject.
This morning, I have fed the turkeys, made a pudding, fed Dart and boiled another mess of rice for him, washed and dressed the baby, and written part of this with baby in my arms.
She talks again, it was writes again and again and again in her letters about the terrible drudgery and the physical exhaustion and the repetition and just the mindless hard work that she has to do. And she hasn't, you know, she has her one servant is about to leave. She can't get any servants in. She's in the middle of the bush.
I do not think I ever told you that Sabina wears a little bell attached to her waist so that when she strays, I may form some idea if she is in danger of harm. I have no small socks for children and have lately been cutting down my own. I wish you to send me out some and some dark gloves for myself. A good size, for my hand is more expanded from work than when in England.
Georgiana gets on in a settler's camp, finds her own beauty there at Flinders Bay, and the Blackwood River, her heart delights in nature so rich and rare as never was seen. She sees this treasure for what it is.
Requests for socks and soap, books and boots were regularly conveyed back to Britain. And coming the other way was an interest in the flora and fauna of the new colony. If settlers lacked the words to express what they saw and heard around them, specimens could speak for themselves.
There was huge interest in the material that was coming from Australia, and especially Western Australia, because our flora is so very rich. And in fact, when you think about it, the only equivalent experience that we could have today would be if we discovered a new planet and sent some people to that planet and they started sending back information or specimens of completely different life forms. That's the only equivalent that we could imagine. Nothing like what was happening then could happen now until we do that.
A number of people in Britain saw the settlement in Western Australia as an opportunity to advance botanical knowledge. And so they started making feelers through the governor and his wife, Ellen Stirling. And Ellen Stirling recommended to a relative of hers, James Mangles, a number of people, including Georgiana Molloy. And so he wrote to those people asking if they would willingly collect for him.
Captain James Mangles, Augusta, Captain James Mangles, Augusta, March 21st, 1837. My dear sir, much to my surprise, in December last, I received a particularly choice box of seeds and the polite note requesting a return of native seeds of Augusta.
In truth, my dear sir,
I much fear you have bestowed your liberality on one whose chief pleasure is her garden, less a botanist. I am not even familiar with the names of the native plants. I will, however, enclose a leaf and description of the flower in each paper. When I obtain a sufficiency to make up a small box, I will dispatch it. Permit me to subscribe myself, yours much obliged, Georgiana Molloy.
She would, like many other educated, cultivated women who came out from England married to someone, they brought a cultural baggage with them, knowledge of botany. They were taught to draw almost from the moment they got up from the breakfast table. They walked, they observed, they took a tremendous interest in the new, especially the new plants and flowers.
Anne Moyle, historian of Australian science. In the 19th century, botany was socially acceptable and encouraged for women. because of its compatibility with religion.
They looked at nature, as the saying went, through nature up to nature's God. So for a lot of them, and some of them actually wrote this in their diaries and so forth, I don't know if Georgiana did, that this was part of their concept, that they were both serving knowledge and they were serving the Creator.
My dear sir, having at length complied with your desire to obtain flowers and seeds from Augusta, I send you the result of my labours.
All these plants were considered to be connected in the great chain of being, leading to humans on the top and God above that. So there was an educational function involved, and it was thought that it was a suitable pursuit for ladies.
But she wasn't just going out in the bush and engaging with nature there. She was also writing about it. What role did the letters take in her life?
I think that's a good question. I think the letters became really quite crucial. I mean, she never met Mangles. He didn't write often, but somehow she decided to form a bond with him and write about much more than just collecting. Particularly one letter that she wrote would have been the second or third letter she'd written to Mangles. She'd only gotten one reply from him, but she presumed a great deal of intimacy in this letter.
We have recently been overwhelmed with the most bitter loss of our darling infant and only son of 19 months old by drowning. Painful as it is to record, distance of place compels me. Captain Molloy, myself and his little sisters had been playing with him just after breakfast on November the 11th, 1837.
She told him about the loss of her son. When he was quite young, he was drowned in a well. That was a tremendously upsetting experience, but she unburdened herself. So Mangles performed some kind of surrogate role for her, an intimate, and she obviously needed that.
He had his bell on, a little bell he wore round his waist in case of straying into the bush. On the servant girls running up and down and not finding him, I exclaimed, "Have you been to the well?" Captain Molloy said, "Do not frighten yourself, he never goes there." The fatal truth stole over me, and on Charlotte going to the well, she said, "Here's the boy," and pulled out the darling precious child, lifeless, his curls dripping. So placid he looked fast asleep, but not dead. We did not know what to do. We tried every means of restoration. And that lovely, healthy child, who had never known pain or sickness, and who had been all mirth and joyousness the last time we beheld him, was now a stiff corpse.
I find that letter tremendously revealing because of the emotion that's expressed in a very restrained way, but it's also somehow more powerful for being so restrained. I mean, she just found it a great relief to be able to talk to someone about this, even someone thousands of miles removed and whom she'd never met. And yet, nevertheless, the relief is palpable when you read this letter because of the detail that it goes into. I mean, there was no need for that detail other than that something that she felt. She felt that need to express herself at length.
I think that was the catalyst for her becoming so involved with collecting plants, because up until that point she hadn't really taken an interest in it.
Historian and writer Jessica White.
She knew how to collect plants and how to fix them into the books, but her brother had asked her to collect specimens. She hadn't done anything. And I think it was this catalyst. She needed something to take her mind off her son drowning. And so she went out to the bush and she became obsessed with collecting flowers for Mangles.
Since my boy's death, my leisure has been much extended, and I have, up to the present time, daily employed it in your service. The purple creeper begins to bloom in July, the red in August, the appellation I give it in ignorance of the proper one.
She would go out into the bush, she would identify plants that she was interested in, monitor their progress through flowering and seed production. It requires keen observation. And remember, at this time, people knew very, very little about the life cycle of plants in Western Australia. The peculiar characteristics were completely unknown.
I am of the opinion that these flowers are not so interesting as our own, and after the novelty has passed, will cease to please. I do not know the name of any one of them, for dear Augusta is quite out of the world, and very few bestow a thought on flowers. Beef, pork, potatoes, onions, anchors and anchorage, whaling and harpooning are the chief topics of conversation.
So here's the collection room where we store the family Proteaceae, one of the largest and most spectacular families in southwest Western Australia. They often have spectacular flower heads, so Banksias, Isopogons, Grevilleas, those types of plants. That in particular would have been an astonishing family for people back in Europe at that time. Part of the reason for the difference is that almost all of the Northern Hemisphere fairly recently was all under ice during the last ice age, and there were no plants growing there at all. As the ice sheets retreated, some plants moved north in Europe, but they were all basically weeds, plants which grow very quickly, which are able to colonise. There's very low diversity of plants in the Northern Hemisphere. In the whole of England, there are many, many fewer plants than there are in a small area of the southwest of Western Australia. And that's what all of the botanists at that time were struggling with, was trying to find out how they could classify these extraordinary plants coming back from the colonies.
The countries of Europe went into open competition to collect plant specimens from across the globe. In Britain, Operations HQ was the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, on the outskirts of London. The flowers and seeds Georgiana Molloy was to collect were sent there, where indeed many of the flowers still are.
Yes, so some of her specimens have been databased and scanned, so you can see them on the web. Yeah.
The director of Kew is West Australian Professor Steve Hopper.
It must have been fantastic times. There are actually more Australian plants grown in the UK then than there are now. Mangles was after seed as well as flowers, so that actually required a system where she collected the flowering plant. And I could draw your attention to the one before us, which is a beautifully preserved specimen of Caledonia herta, which is the sugar candy orchid. It's a white-flowered little spider orchid from southwestern Australia, standing about 20, 30 centimetres high. And it has very delicate flowers that wither rapidly after you pick it, unless you press it immediately. And on the type sheet, you can see all her specimens, which are superbly preserved, with the flowers looking as fresh as they were on the day she picked them.
Orchids are my favourites.
Why? What is it about them?
Well, they're just very complex. You get fairy orchids that are only, what's that, about 4 or 5 centimetres? And then you get large spider orchids. And there are people here that go hunting orchids like they're orchid watchers instead of bird watchers. They go out with binoculars and scan the forest or something. It's amazing.
When she collected the specimen, it's very clear that she put it straight into a press, which I think in those days would have been what's called a hortus siccus, which was basically a book, a big book. And each page you'd put a separate specimen in. What she then had to do was mark the plants in some way, and then she and her daughters would come out regularly to check how advanced they were. With the orchids, for example, they have very fine dust-like seeds, and you only have a window of about 2 weeks from when the capsule starts to split and all the seeds are dispersed. The flowering specimen would have been collected in September. The seeds are released around December, January. So she would have had to have been back in the bush, been able to locate these plants when they weren't flowering, so she'd have to recognise them from the leaf or some marker she left on the plant, and then watch very carefully and look at the ovary, see if it was swelling, and then watch when it dried out and started to split, and just catch it at that point, just as it started to split.
I have some friends in Fremantle who are orchid enthusiasts, and I went out with them, and they kept saying, how sexy the orchids are. Because you can see all the, you know, the sexual anatomy of the orchids. Look at that one. Isn't that one sexy?
In this uncultivated land and temperate climate, insects and reptiles have unrestrained license, and the seeds of each plant afforded sustenance to some of the animal creation. Consequently, the seeds' vessels are generally inhabited by some worm or grub. I had several large quantities of numbers 67, 71 and 85 to gather and open before I could meet the small packages sent you.
She numbered each of her flowering specimens starting from one and up to however many hundred she collected. One of the big problems was that a lot of the seeds that were being sent to the UK were eaten by bugs of various sorts. And to avoid that, she sprinkled lots of pepper in with the seeds to stop insects from doing that.
Did that work?
Apparently so, because the horticulturalists who received her seed were quite ecstatic.
Since Saturday last, I have been engaged in your service, always working from after breakfast till 12:30 at night. I do not know how the specimens will arrive, but at least they will afford amazement to your botanical friends and will, I believe, be the first in Britain from this part of the world. My anxiety that you should possess them rouses all my energy to prepare them for embarkation on Monday, February 3rd.
You know, for somebody to write a letter and ship it off in such uncertain circumstances and to wait months and months and months for a reply that may never come, I don't know how you can cope with that. You had to find satisfaction in the writing of the letter itself. But the letters did reach Mangles and he did reply, and you know, they established a correspondence, which again must have been enormously satisfying to her, even at such a large remove, even over such a long period of time.
January the 31st, 1840. Dear Captain Mangles, I received your long wished for letter on the 10th of December, a day or two after the box. Words fail me when I attempt to return you my grateful thanks and acknowledgements for its useful, beautiful and handsome contents. In my few stolen moments of leisure, I run to my box of treasures and take a glance at some of the books with which I am really delighted. My first request to you is that you will oblige me by sending the names of the different flowers according to their numbers.
She wants the knowledge back, so she wants a kind of conversation or dialogue to be set up with Mangles. Some of it is quite self-deprecating, that, you know, she says she doesn't know the names of things, but then in other parts of her letters and in other letters, she displays quite an extensive botanical knowledge. So it's also a way for her to think of herself as in that educated class of people who engage in scientific discussion and debate, who think about plants and science and not just the kind of really mundane things that she was often forced to converse about in Australia.
As she began to write to him, she included these descriptions of a landscape that was so poetic, so beautiful, that I thought she really loves writing, and she loves writing about plants and her surroundings. And sometimes there's this playfulness and flirtation in her writing, and sometimes there's something vaguely sensual and erotic in here. It may not be seduction, but it's certainly a pleasure of some form.
She's very articulate. She uses words in a really beautiful way. And it's also very active writing. She uses lots of verbs. The way that her sentences are made up are very kind of active sentences.
August the 1st, 1840. We went for a ride a few days ago. The ground was adorned with crimson flowers. All at once, after going through an interminable grove of Jacksonia, we came on an open plain of many acres in extent, scarcely a tree on it, and those that grew large and fine. I discovered a plant I had been almost panting for, a very small, neat, white blossom. We found a large quantity of it.
There was a line in one of Georgiana's letters. She was writing to Mangles, and she said, "I've found this plant which I've been panting for." And I thought, oh, that's very odd. Like, she hasn't used such a loaded word anywhere else. And it's like these little touches or these little clues all the way through her writing. There's this constant longing to see the person on the other side of the world. He was writing a book on plants. And she said, "I only have one request, and that's that you put your lithographic portrait in the front of the book, and then I can see face to face the person who's been veiled from me. She uses that word, veiled. I think the phrase was she was capriciously veiled from sight, or something like that.
Then I should see face to face the person whom fate has so capriciously veiled from sight, but made so instrumental in bestowing kindness and gratification at so remote a part of the globe. Our acquaintance is both singular and tantalising, and somewhat melancholy to me, my dear sir, to reflect on. We shall never meet in this life. We may mutually smooth and cheer the rugged path of this world's existence by strewing flowers in our way, but we never can converse with each other. And I am sincere when I say, I never met with anyone who so perfectly called forth and could sympathise with me in my prevailing passion for flowers. I have just heard that the vessel positively sails on Monday. Therefore, I must, however reluctantly, shorten this.
Her arm and eyes, in gentle ways, impressed all those who met her. Yet sharp as a thorn, stuck in her hand, she recognized her calling. I'll get this seed, send it back to England.
My name is Louisa Wise, and I wrote this song about Georgiana Molloy. I'm proud of it. I don't always like what I write, but I do like this one very much.
What I'm finding really fascinating now is discovering how many other people are connecting with Georgiana and the kind of fascination that people have with her story. It seems like it's a bit of a box that once you open, you start to see connections in lots of different places.
I don't know her stature. I'd love to know whether she was tall or short. Masses of thick, fair hair.
Pretty? Is she pretty?
Yes, I would say she's beautiful.
I feel like she's often there before me, Georgiana, that is. Because what I'm trying to do now is work up a whole lot of designs using Australian or Southwest Australian plants. And in one of her letters, I suddenly remembered her saying, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a tablecloth embroidered with our own flowers, you know, instead of the roses and the honeysuckles.
Holly's story is a visual artist, working primarily in textiles, based in Fremantle and the southwest of WA.
I've seen her pressed plant specimens in the herbarium at Kew. They show up how tender she was with her research and how particular. And looking at them, you also get the impression you're looking at sort of faded old bits of cloth or ribbons. I wanted to sort of honour the fact of her scientific rigour and curiosity next to her incredibly demanding domestic life.
The romantic love of nature in Georgiana is very, very active, but what makes her kind of extraordinary is that she approaches the bush from a kind of scientific point of view and she uses a rational framework. So there's this kind of tension between these two ways of experiencing, or two ways of articulating, two ways of making sense of a place.
It had never been easy for the first party of British settlers in Augusta. The huge carry trees had taken days to fell, and farming was not a success. In 1839, the Molloy household, following others, moved north to a new settlement on the Vass River, close to the current site of Busselton.
August 1840. A fourth daughter was born early this year. In my illness, I did not forget you. As spring approached, I lamented not being able to gather the flowers as they came out. I was surprised during my illness to receive a nosegay from a native who was aware of my floral passion. These are under preparation for you.
At the time, in the late 1830s, early 1840s, that was when armed conflict started to develop with the Noongar people and the colonial Europeans. And so there was a lot of concern, and she gives accounts in her letters of her husband being called away as a magistrate to deal with infringements in European law by Noongar people. There was an if you like, considerable concern about an uprising, armed conflict developing with Aboriginal people. And yet she was at the same time going out in the bush on her own with Aboriginal men and women and children who were, she comments, superbly adept at finding different sorts of flowers, didn't question why you would do this sort of thing, and were very able companions. So quite a contrast in attitude towards the people in these first few years of initial engagement.
Yes, it's clear that Georgiana Molloy has congenial relationships with named local Indigenous people. She exchanges goods with Indigenous people who collect plants for her or keep her informed about plants and their state in terms of whether they're about to fruit or seed or so on.
But her relationships with Indigenous people weren't radical, I take it.
No, I think she didn't see it as inconsistent to be friendly to those people and yet to be claiming and occupying and transforming the land that was theirs. She knows that they have this incredible knowledge of the local area and of the local plants and animals, and she draws on that knowledge to some extent, but she doesn't seem to see that as contradicting her own part in the colonial project of settlement, you know, of which her gardening and her botanising were intimately a part.
The thing we need to remember is that while she's out in the bush, enjoying the bush, much of her life in Australia was spent being pregnant. I mean, she had 7 children and she only lived 12 years in Western Australia, so that gives you the proportion of time she spent being pregnant and giving birth.
April 11th, 1842. Dear Captain Mangles, I have been 4 times out in search of Neutzia and send you the small, small harvest. The seed is very difficult to obtain, if not there the day it ripens. I am never able to find more than 2 seeds in a capsule.
And yet, I guess because it was expected of women, it doesn't figure prominently in her letters to Mangles. What does figure is the joy she took in her children. But also we know from other sources that with each successive pregnancy, she grew weaker and weaker and weaker. The references she makes to Mangles are in the form of a sort of apology that she wasn't up to going out into the bush, and this becomes more frequent the longer the relationship goes on, until of course finally she gives birth to her 7th child and she doesn't really recover from that experience. She develops septicemia, or at least that's my interpretation based on a lot of reading, and she ultimately succumbs to that.
My name is Patrick Richardson Bunbury. Georgiana Molloy was my great-great-grandmother.
Patrick Bunbury is currently active in transcribing much of the correspondence of Georgiana Molloy, almost all of it outgoing, as part of a new media project.
My great-grandmother, Amelia, confessed to destroying all the inward mail, and she regretted it very much. So there's nothing that came in. Very little of Kimmy has survived, which is very sad.
Here we have the folder, which is the compilation of the research done for the new media project on Georgiana Molloy.
Jennifer Girardi, whose company JAG Films in Margaret River has received funding to devise an interactive website for Georgiana Molloy.
We like the idea of having one simple item on the screen, which is Georgiana's locket. And when you put the cursor on the locket, it opens and you enter into the world of Georgiana Molloy. Once you're inside that, you can choose to have a linear chronological story Or you can actually go into more of the themes, either the botany, the indigenous themes, literature, religion. So you've got a number of ways of navigating through that site.
There's all the elements of intrigue, of exotic and foreign places, of hardship as a young wife raising kids in the bush in a completely new environment, dying as a young woman in her 30s, and yet doing this wonderful connection with the Australian bush so early on. These days, many people empathise with a lot more than would have in her day.
But why should we remember somebody who collected things that were already there?
Well, that raises the question of why should we develop an understanding of and name animals and plants worldwide? And the short answer is that without a name, things go unrecognised, unloved, and often are just swept aside in ignorance. The power of Western science naming and understanding the living world is that it opens up all sorts of opportunities for people now and in the future. So it's a grand enterprise.
But the irony then is that Georgiana Molloy's name wasn't stitched into botanical language until the 1970s. James Drummond, the West Australian colonial government botanist, had proposed naming a plant after her in 1842, the year before her death. But there was hesitation over the claim, someone else went on to name the same plant differently, and the matter was dropped. The 20th century picked up the pieces and restored the name, which put Georgiana Molloy securely into scientific literature. However, the consequence has been the discovery of a far more complex figure than previously imagined.
There were several levels at which she was reconceiving herself through this activity. There's the act of writing to Mangles, being a part of this larger enterprise. She knew there was a larger enterprise being involved. The fact of physically being in the bush and relating to her children, relating to Aborigines and relating to the land in a different way. So all those things combined to give her what we might call a more authentic identity.
She has a very contemporary resonance because women still struggle with loneliness, their first child, balancing work and home. She embraced what she came to and she made the best use she could of it. I think that's inspiring. You don't retreat behind the known.
And primarily, I think, it's just those extraordinary letters. She was a great writer.
Her writing has got this magical quality. It's beautiful and it's poetic. And possibly the other people who are interested in her writing have had that same feeling that I have, that it struck some kind of chord and there's something that needs to be untangled and deciphered.
How has she been remembered in this area?
Remembered? Well, she's always been remembered by the Historical Society, who put up the plaque where her house was. Now you've got Busselton, where she's buried. It has Georgiana Molloy School, so her name will be there all the while.
This is the third Friday, 3 weeks running, my dear friend, that I have been employed in your service. It is a lovely, luminous morning, cloudy with gently falling showers, and beautiful, gigantic peppermint trees in front of where I write. I have been out again for Neutzia and Kingia. I should like nothing better than to kindle a fire and stay out all night, as I should be ready for my work in the morning.
You've been listening to Botany and the Bush, Georgiana Molloy and her passion for flowers. Many thanks to all those who participated in the making of this program. Thanks too to the Western Australian Herbarium, the State Library of WA, JAG Films of Margaret River and the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. Lucy Bell read from the letters and diaries of Georgiana Molloy. Other readings were by Andrew McLennan and the pianist was Stephen Crittenden. Technical production was by Andrei Shabunov, and the program was produced by Jennifer Bowen. You can get more information and see photos of some of the flowers that Georgiana Molloy collected on the Hindsight website.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast.
ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.